This is Angela Ewing with KCIW Curry Coast Community Radio. Story Time, Episode 3, 9 O'Clock Horses. I was sent to live with my father's sister, Aunt Dorothy, and her family in the village of Foxby, just 17 miles north of Leicester. Foxby did not have thatched cottages, crooked half-timbered houses like the streets in Lavenham, or the stone cottages in the Coxwells that are the quintessential essence of England. However, there was a Saxon church by the duck pond, a school, a post office, a hardware store, and several other little shops, including the ubiquitous fish and chip shop. Small brick houses, mostly built in twos, we call semi-detached, boasted pretty gardens with brightly coloured painted doors. The village was surrounded by green fields separated by hawthorn hedges. Sheep's wool hung to the thorny growth, and cows grazed peacefully in almost every field. The family to which I now temporarily belonged didn't have to worry about food rationing. They had a cow. They made butter and cheese. Chickens roamed around the field next to their house, which stood atop a narrow, often muddy lane. My cousin Elise, or Ellie, as everyone called her, she was 10 and had a high opinion of herself, always taking charge to show me how things were done around the house and in the garden. Her father, my Uncle Walter, was a market gardener. He had two enormous greenhouses at the very end of the village, one for exotic ferns and orchids, the other for seedlings and flowers he used for bridal bouquets. Ellie knew the names of all the flowers. She taught me how to disbud the roses, so that only one bud would remain to develop into a beautiful bloom. Uncle Walter loved freesias. Often I would sit on one of the tall stalks in the greenhouse, when they were in full bloom, to breathe in their heady perfume. The greenhouse exuded an aroma of promise, new growth, earthy and clean, unfettered by the vagaries of our wartime existence in the city. In those rare moments of solitude, I thought about my brother and sister and my dad, of course. Most often, my thoughts would turn to my mother. I was torn between a feeling of disappointment and of abandonment. After all, she had decided to leave me. In her suicide attempt, she had abandoned us all. Young as I was, it was in those moments that I began to wonder why she was so unhappy most of the time. Was it just the war, or were there some underlying events that would cause her to want to end her life? I had never known any other person who tried once, let alone twice. The answers eluded me until I started to spend more time with my father's mother, my grandmother Louise, and her spinster daughter Olive. They were in the adjoining house to my aunt's, and from the outside, they looked identical. Inside, it was different in so many ways. The antithesis of Aunt Dorothy and Uncle Walter's house. Instead of the well-worn, comfortable furniture in their living room, Grandma's house was another world to me, with beautiful furniture, shelves of books lined up to the ceiling in the library, a fire always burning brightly in the front room, and apart from the steady tick-tock of the grandfather clock in the corner, the whole place seemed hushed to me. I was in awe of everything that seemed to be always in place. One would never expect to see a wilted bloom among the artistically arranged flowers on the dining room table. The silver tray on the sideboard with the glass decanter and two or three crystal glasses was always highly polished. I soon learned why everything was so orderly. Ellie explained with great aplomb that my father's parents had been in service at the Kilby Manor as maid and butler when they were young. Lord and Lady Winstanley had imparted to them a genteel way of life they had followed all their married life. Looking back now, I believe this reverence for order and gentility rubbed off on my father. Even our neighbors at home seemed to look on him as something a little more than we. And heaven forbid if you called him Edward or Ed. Everyone called him Mr. Norton. Of course, in those days, children did not call their elders by their first name, but my father carried with him an air of authority. He had a mustache that curled up at the ends neatly, and he tended to look down his nose when speaking. I often sensed that the aura of superiority he exuded was an irritant to my mother, causing her to belittle him when a discussion arose about his parents or her own, or if we had visitors for tea. Her sarcasm was rampant at times, especially after a second glass of sherry, and was probably exacerbated by the fact my father appeared to take it in his stride, looking at her over the top of his glasses and smiling in his condescending fashion. Over time, I started to understand her resentment. I believe it was her inability to adapt to his desire for perfection and properness in all things. Living with my father, his high ideals and great expectations of everything and everybody in his life seemed to anger her. I remember one Sunday dinner time an incident that clearly depicted my mother's disdain for my father. Pauline had set the table. Mother brought the hot dishes of food from the kitchen and placed them on the mats, already there. Everything was ready to give our thanks. My mother was always the one to say grace. Before the war, we always had a first course, soup or maybe half a grapefruit, but it was wartime and citrus was not imported from Spain. We never had a salad, for that was supper or high tea. So on a Sunday, we had Yorkshire pudding as a first course served with gravy. Yorkshire pudding is what Americans call popovers, usually with the main meal. Because everything was rationed, there was a very small roast beef, pork or lamb carved thinly by my father. He would place one or two slices carefully on everyone's plate. It was ceremoniously carried out, everything done in the right order. We didn't have much conversation at the dinner table, ever. We helped ourselves to a huge spoonful of mashed potatoes and literally slopping them on my father's plate. Her act was ferocious. I watched my father's face. He closed his eyes and winced as though she had struck him. He looked at her for just a second before he rose from the table and left the room. Even as a little girl, I could feel my father's hurt. His sensitivity to all things crass left him speechless. The look of satisfaction on my mother's face as she tucked into her dinner made me afraid. Before the war, Great Britain imported large amounts of food from other countries. There was, and still is, no way that England can sustain itself, food-wise, for its huge population. So in 1940, the government introduced ration books. Everyone was allowed the same amount of food per week. Meat was purchased by price up to 1 shilling and 6 pence. Allowance for sugar was 8 ounces per week. 1 fresh egg per person per week. 3 pints of milk, 4 ounces of margarine, and 12 ounces of sweets every 4 weeks. There was no ice cream during the war, but we always had dessert after dinner, stewed fruit, usually apples from our tree in my father's allotment. We probably had a healthy diet with fresh vegetables from the garden, tended carefully during the summer weekends, and with extra eggs from our chickens. We had fish for dinner often because that was not rationed. The war was over. I had been living in Foxby for a year. I had not seen or heard from my mother. Phone calls from Pauline and my father were vague. "She's getting better," or "She's okay, having some treatment or rather," was their usual response to my questions. Sitting with my cousin one morning after a breakfast of fried bread, bacon and egg, my aunt called to me from the hall. "There's a phone call from your sister." I hurried to the telephone. "Hello? Hello, love, how are you?" "I'm all right." My new boyfriend has a car, Pauline said, emphasizing the word car. He and I are going to the hospital to see Mum. Do you want to go with us? At that moment, I wasn't quite sure. I had hidden those terrible memories of the time I found her in our gas-filled house. It was another world away, somewhere on an alien planet, nightmarish, a place I did not want to be. Pauline's voice interrupted my hesitation. Well, do you want to come or not? Richard said he didn't mind driving to Foxby to pick you up. He's really nice. Oh, all right then, I said. We'll pick you up around 2, she said. Be ready, will you, because they don't allow visitors after 5. It was the smell of the place that made me shudder. Strange sounds came from closed doors along the corridors, painted with what was known as Eau de Nil, water of the Nile. I reached for Pauline's hand and we walked into a large room where a circle of upright chairs were arranged. No one was sitting in the circle. A few women in armchairs sat around the perimeter of the room. It was in one of these chairs that my mother sat, staring into space. I could feel my heart racing as we went to her. My sister kissed her cheek. Mother smiled up at her. Hello, she said softly. How nice of you to come. She didn't smell like my mother anymore when I reached up to give her a hug. Her eyes were almost black, not the lovely deep blue I remembered. I must have stared at her for a moment too long, and Pauline gave me a nudge and motioned for me to sit down. So, how have you been? My sister queried as she settled herself into a chair next to my mother. Mother nodded. Fine, fine. They've got me on something. Medicine? Yes. So where's this new boyfriend you mentioned? Oh, they only allow family. Oh. My sister leaned forward. What are they giving you? What is happening? Are you feeling better? Electric shock treatment and hypnotism. That's what they do here. Electric shock treatment and hypnotism try to make you remember things. And do you? Well, I told them about the 9 o'clock horses. Pauline looked at me and raised her eyebrows. She turned back to my mother. What horses? Didn't I ever tell you about the horses? Suddenly she looked away. A vacant look came over her face and her mouth dropped open. Her hands went to her side. Mom, Pauline said, shaking my mother and rousing her. Mom! My mother's voice suddenly rose. They were always there, ready to get me, those 9 o'clock horses. My mother warned me I should have listened. I wanted to cry. The room was dark, sinister, horrifying to me, sitting there with this woman who seemed to be in a world of her own. She wasn't my mother. What had they done to her? I said, I want to go home, Pauline. Let's go. Please, let's go. Mother looked up at me. Her glare was hostile. You go back to your father and that fancy woman he has. You and him, you're just alike. As I was running from the room, I heard my sister say, for goodness sake, she's just a kid. She's staying with Dorothy and Walter now. I waited at the door, wondering if my mother would answer. She did. Well, isn't that a surprise? Of course she's living with his precious relatives, she said. Edward wanted me to live in that village, you know. Did you know that? I wouldn't mix with that lot. They all laughed at me when I went to see them for the first time. Me in my lovely dress and high heels. I wasn't a country girl. I wasn't one to be among that cow shit. My sister fled from the room, and then we were almost running down the green corridor and out into the late afternoon sunshine to Richard sitting in his car reading a newspaper. Pauline and I sat silently on the way back to Foxby. I wasn't to learn about the 9 o'clock horses or other events in my mother's life until much later. I had been attending the local village school in Foxby since I arrived. For some reason, a boy named Colin took a fancy to me. He often bought me an ice cream from the general store in the village after school and usually accompanied me to my aunt's house, kicking a stone along the street from side to side like a football. When we got to the gate at the top of the lane, he would open it as wide as it would go, turn and wave to me before letting the gate close behind him. There was a rubber tire nailed to the gate, but the loud thud was enough to rouse the curiosity of my grandmother, who always kept an eye on the comings and goings of the villagers on their Sunday afternoon walks through the fields. Colin would laugh merrily when a face appeared at the window of my aunt's house. Then he'd run fast along the path to his parents' farm on the other side of the bridge. There was a canal that ran through the fields near Colin's house. Locals referred to the canal as the Cut. It was one of hundreds of canals built throughout the English countryside to allow barges to transport coal from Newcastle to Leicester, Birmingham, and Coventry. Coal was used to fuel enormous furnaces of the factories during the Industrial Revolution. Leicester was the richest city in the county, with its pound per head capita. Famous for its woolen goods, hosiery, boots and shoes, the tall chimneys all belched black smoke that turned the Monday morning lines of washing to dirty grey. But as my father had often said, where there's muck, there's money. The bridge over the canal was a favourite place to gather, because the waterways were always busy with barges carrying coal to the factories in the city. Colin and I would watch from the bridge, waiting to see the barge pulled by a horse down the towpath. When they reached the bridge, the horse was unlocked from the line attached to the barge. Then the horse was led over the bridge, past us to the towpath on the other side of the canal, and rehooked to the barge. "What will happen when they get to the tunnel?" I remember asking Colin. He said he didn't know about that. When I asked my uncle, he said the horse would be led over the top of the tunnel by one of the men, and the other men on the barge would lie on the top of the roof and push along with their feet. It was hard for me to imagine that, but I could think of no other way it could be done. Horse and barge remained an efficient way to haul bulk cargo between cities and villages in the Midlands of England well into the 1950s. Anything from coal to cast iron. One Saturday, Ellie decided to accompany me to the bridge to meet Colin. When we spotted a family of ducks paddling around the bridge, Colin and Ellie recited together the rhyme from Wind in the Willows. All along the backwater through the rushes tall, ducks are a-dabbling, up tails all. They had been given the same book to read in the same class at school. For a brief moment, I felt a pang of jealousy. "Kenneth Graham wrote that," Colin said proudly. Hadley's farm was visible from the bridge. It stood on a knoll in the middle of a field among several outbuildings. The field next to the farm was always yellow with cowslips, a rare species of primrose with very long stems that I loved to pick and take to my grandmother or aunt. I noticed when Ellie hadn't been with us, Colin helped me to pluck these delicate blooms, but today he sat on the bank watching us. I wondered why that was. Did he believe she would think less of him if he picked flowers? Did it matter to him what she thought? I decided he liked her more than me. But it soon became obvious that Ellie thought herself far too high and mighty to be associated with a farm boy. Ellie and I were close most of the time, although I could tell she thought I was of lesser breed, being from the city, especially with a mother that was a bit daft in the head. She included me in most of her activities, and for that I was grateful, even though I knew it was because she felt sorry for me. Aunt Dorothy was wonderful, as was Uncle Walter. They treated me like they did Ellie. In almost every way, I loved them both. I learned what it was like to be in a household where laughter and love exist between husband and wife. I wanted to be part of that always. And when my father came to take me home one bright sunny day, telling me my mother was home, I cried. Colin had come to the house to say goodbye. Just as I was getting into my father's car, he handed me a book, Wild Flowers of England. In between a folded piece of paper, in the middle, was a pressed cowslip. It was dry and flat, but it had retained most of its colour. Colin waved as we sped away. I knew then I loved him. This is Angela Ewing with Storytime. You've been listening to episode 3 of 9 O'Clock Horses. Stay tuned for episode 4 next week. If you enjoyed this program and want to hear more like it, consider supporting Curry Coast Community Radio and help us get on the air. For more information, go to our website, kciw.org. Thank you for listening.